My name is Christopher Armitage. I'm running for the U.S. House of Representatives against Kathy McMorris Rodgers, our 16-year incumbent. I am an Air Force veteran. I deployed to the Middle East twice, where I served as security forces and a base defense operations controller. I have a Master's of Science in Homeland Security and undergrad in criminal justice. I've also worked in law enforcement as a 911 operator and as a background investigator.
So I assume you did some of this here at Fairchild, and where else have you been stationed? Where else have you worked?
That was my only base for two enlistments, actually. But I deployed out of there to the Iraq-Kuwait border and the Oman-Emirates border.
So what did you do in those places?
Mostly involves driving around in a truck or an up-armored Humvee with your rifle in the back seat or the seat next to you, and in my case, sometimes an M203 attached to my M4 or an M240 or an M249, a few different weapons we used. And then also part of that work was, being in a room surrounded by flat-screen TVs, and they had cameras on everything, and you had sensors on everything, and the sensors would go off sometimes. And if I was working as the base defense operations controller, I'd send people out to go check it out. Or if I was working security, I'd go drive out and find whatever tumbleweed or animal tripped the alarm.
So what was it like being out there, knowing that you could drive anytime and something could blow up from underneath you at any time?
You know what's interesting about that? So interesting with PTSD. So the people most likely to get PTSD aren't the people who see combat most. The people most likely to get it are those who never know when they're going to get attacked, when they're going to be in harm's way. For example, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, they know, hey, at 8 p.m., we're going to be in danger. And so they're less likely to suffer. Now, I'll tell you, oftentimes when I was in those areas, I was part of more defensive forces to draw a line that we didn't want people to cross. ISIS for the first half, and then Al-Qaeda for Al-Qaeda on the first deployment, and ISIS on the second. And I was more worried about, hey, how am I going to help family members who have medical bills? Because I've seen shame in a lot of folks' eyes who are good people, even in my own family, when they know that they're not going to be able to pay a $2,000 copay. And I wanted to help them out, and just I knew how unfair it was. I love my family, I love my friends, I love my community, and it's those things that I had in the military of amazing health care, education without crippling debt, a living wage, guaranteed housing. I want those to extend to the people I love, and so that was a big thing for me when I was in the military.
So when you were overseas, I mean, could you focus on any of that stuff while you were, pretty
mostly
much focused on just trying to stay alive and do your job?
Mostly I was focused on how hot it was, to be honest with you. I know it's not the most exciting answer, but it was about 140 degrees. I was wearing 60 pounds of gear and dumping water bottles full of cold water underneath my vest and that kind of thing. I don't know. Different folks have different ways of coping. The first deployment was tough emotionally. I came back in not such a great spot. The second one, I was nervous, but I said, this is an opportunity for me to learn and grow and have it go better than the first one. And so I spent a lot of time journaling and, self-educating, and I came out of that second one a stronger person.
So as you look back on it, what are the things that you did learn that you carry with you today?
Yeah, listening is the main one. I remember, so you when you're working security or law enforcement, you're in a vehicle a lot of times with someone for a 14-hour shift, and that person is seated in the passenger seat or the driver's seat, and they could be from rural Alabama, they could be from deep in the Bronx. And either way, you're going to have to sit next to them for 14 hours. And if your flight sergeant is any good and they find out you two don't get along, they're going to post you together every single day, because I was an assistant flight sergeant, and that's what I did. You're going to get along, and we'll keep putting you together until you do. And so the ability to really listen when other people are talking, I hope to keep that with me the rest of my life and practice it every single day.
And then how would you use that as a congressman?
That's a really good question. The way to use that as a congressman is to hear people out even when you disagree with them. And there's a lot of people who've come on to support the campaign for that exact reason, is because they can see that I'm not just talking to people who agree with every policy I have. And what I learn on the trail, on the campaign trail, is that when you listen to people, when they really feel heard, a lot of times they'll end up respecting you even when you disagree. But when they can tell that you're doing the standard politician thing of not wanting to give a straight answer, they're not going to respect you. Even the people who agree with you aren't going to respect you under those circumstances. They're not going to be excited to vote, and you're never going to flip somebody.
So you we'll talk about some of your policy positions in a little bit, but I understand you've been spending a lot of time in the rural areas of the district. Why? Why is that? Why has that been important to you?
There's a few reasons, and I want to use this as an opportunity to mention that in March we're going to be hitting at least 30 incorporated towns and reservations throughout the district. It's going to be a district-wide tour, and it's something I'm going to want to do multiple times. We're going to bring canvassers out. We're going to hold events. We're going to meet with people. And a big part of the why comes from two people who've advised me recently. One is Sally Jackson, Grandma Sal. She's a fellow comic. I've opened for her a few times, and former chair of a local Democratic Party. And also Heather Foley, who's Tom Foley, Representative Tom Foley's widow. And I spoke to both of them, and exactly what they said to me was he kept getting elected from 64 up until his final term because he spent as much time outside of Spokane as inside of Spokane. You could see him at the grocery store. You could see him at your local tavern, even in, say, Lincoln County or up in Ponderay. And that's what he did when he was first running, too. He went out to every corner of this district, and he shook hands at the taverns and at the churches, and he said, "My name's Tom Foley. I'm running to represent you in Congress." And I wholeheartedly believe that that's how you break through the media bubble. You show people, hey, I'm actually here to listen to you, and even where we disagree, I want you to know that you can count on my character and my judgment.
And so is that working as you go to places like Republic and Walla Walla and, you know, La Crosse?
Absolutely it is. We just did a town hall in Walla Walla. And there were a few hundred people there, many of whom were farmers. And it was a great opportunity to hear them out and have good conversations. And, you know, some of it was new and interesting as a you know, someone who hasn't, you know, I haven't held elected office before. And even as a comic, you know, it's not quite the same feeling when you're out in public. I remember walking out after the forum and just had a really good time answering people's concerns and felt like they were receptive. Some people seemed nervous or apprehensive when I was around, and I looked over at one of my friends and I said, "Did I do something wrong?" And they said, "No, you're just the guy running for Congress who was sitting in front of them for an hour talking." And so that was a new experience, but you know, the opportunity to really get with folks on their level is why I'm in this. I've been continually frustrated by people in politics who, I don't know, I'm just going to say it, elitist. I'm a working class guy. My dad had a lot of different jobs. He worked for the railroad. He was an HVAC repairman. My grandfather was a Teamster delivery driver. And that's the background I come from. And so just the opportunity to speak to these folks in these different areas and who've never met someone running for Congress before, they like it. You know, we actually ran an ad a while ago targeted on Facebook, targeted to Trump supporters. And it said, "Are you mad at a Democrat? Give one a call." Now imagine how mad somebody has to be to call up a stranger to yell at them. And if they didn't hang up in the first 5 minutes, we would talk for an hour or two. And I made legitimate friends. I really did. People felt heard. They felt listened to. And I got invitations to come out to their homes out in Springdale, and it was an eye-opening experience too, because there's not a lot of people who not a lot of jobs and careers and those kind of things and life positions where you end up talking to people you might have never spoken to before.
And how much did it help that you've got this military background and you've been deployed a couple of times overseas?
Yeah, it almost feels like a lot of things in my life led up to preparing me for this. As a former 911 operator, I regularly spoke to people who, whether it was they said they wanted to kill themselves, and I was the one on the phone with them. And in the Air Force, you can be military police as young as 18 years old. And you get those phone calls, or you get someone who's old enough to be your parent calling you saying, "Hey, me and my 5-year-old son were jumping on the bed and he fell off and hit his head and now he's unconscious." And you're the one on the phone. Or whether you're the law enforcement officer who drives out to that house and you get there just because you were in the neighborhood, you get there before the AMR and medical help and fire department. And those conversations, those experiences really taught me a lot about how to communicate with people and how to listen to them and how to show them that I'm here to help. You know, on a good day, being a cop is like being a superhero. And there's probably a lot of folks who, you know, are upset with law enforcement, and I can understand that. And I don't work in that field anymore for a reason, because I have some objections with laws in this country. But on a good day, you know, like you find a kid, or you see, you're driving past the park and you see a kid who's crying, and you just decide to pull over. And then it turns out his arm is bent backwards because he fell off his skateboard. And that happened. And it was horrible. It's like, I'm the one here to help. And that means a lot. You feel like you're actually making a positive impact. And I think that kind of informs what I do now.
So when you go talk to one of those farmers down in Walla Walla County, or you know, up in Stevens County or something, where are the areas that you're most likely to connect with them in terms of, you know, the platform that you talk about? Where are the areas that you're going to maybe get him to consider the fact that you've got a D behind your name, but maybe he'll consider voting for you?
Healthcare, housing, and jobs. Right there, to put it succinctly. You know, I mean, they're concerned about, say, having arable land, and 85% of the money that we give to farmers goes to the top 1% of farmers. It doesn't go to our small farms. And the majority of farmers in, say, the Walla Walla Valley make less than $250,000 a year, which is a small farm. And so they want some of the support for green technology. They're interested in having a livable planet. The farmers there, they're 400 feet above sea level in the Walla Walla Valley. They know that the climate is changing. They know that they're getting less and less winter every single year, that the winter's becoming less predictable. They were holding on to some harvests, for example, a little bit longer for their wine, and then they ended up with an early frost, and it destroyed a bunch of their crops. They ended up needing a small bailout for that. And so these farmers, they want their communities to be reinvigorated. For example, the average age of a farmer, the average farmer in the United States is a 58-year-old white man. They want it to be a viable path for their children. They want new people to be able to enter the farming community. And these rural towns, they are losing their young populations because they don't have jobs. It's not viable for young people to stay in these communities right now. And a lot of this district was built thanks to New Deal policies. It really was, you know, Water Conservation Society and a lot of different groups facilitated the communities that are now struggling once again.
All right, so let's talk about things that are on your placard here. Let's start with Medicare for All. That's one of those really controversial, quote unquote. Why do you support Medicare for All?
Well, I'll tell you, it's manufactured controversy to start, because 70% of Americans want Medicare for All. 30% of Congress wants it. That doesn't sound very representative to me. In fact, Medicare for All has a higher approval rating than Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, when I speak to communities, they know that we have a healthcare crisis. We have tens of thousands of people who are dying because of lack of access to healthcare. I met with a family recently who lost their 19-year-old son to cancer that was preventable because the insurance company wouldn't run a test they called exploratory. And then once he developed symptoms, it was already too late. And everybody's got these stories. I go out to rural communities. You send me up to Newport, I end up talking to a family who has three diabetic members, and they're splitting one prescription between the three of them. Now, you might have your issues with Medicare for All, but as a former commander of mine used to say, there's the best answer is the right answer. The second best answer is the wrong answer. And the worst answer is no answer. And right now, I don't see a lot of answers when it comes to our representatives.
So how do you get past the notion of the S word? It's socialist medicine. How do you get past that? Because once you say that word, a lot of people's ears just completely close up.
Medicare and Social Security are two of the most popular policies in this country. People are grateful for them. And you have folks out there who say, keep the government off my Medicare. And that's just, it's misguided. Okay, now, for some reason, the media and a lot of sources and my opponent only call it socialism when it helps people. Now, when my opponent voted to give the banks billions of dollars, they weren't screaming socialism. It's time for the American people to get their bailout. We have counties with a third of the population under the poverty line. One third of people. In Walla Walla Public Schools, 60% of the students are on reduced or free lunch. And while the president and our representative brag about unemployment numbers, shows you how little they know about Eastern Washington, we have counties with 10% unemployment. this district has been forgotten. And they can say S, they can say socialism, they can say whatever they want, but I want to take care of these people, my family, my community, my friends here in Eastern Washington. And it happens by using pragmatic policies that bring jobs, health care, and housing.
So how do you pay for Medicare for All and ensure that people aren't paying more than they're paying for health care right now?
Our government spends more money on health care than any other government on earth. And what's crazy about that, what's ridiculous about that, is our private citizens also spend more than any other country on earth. We spend more than twice as much as most other countries. So the system we have, I don't believe you could create a more expensive system if you tried. 3,000% markups don't come from taxes. This system has been manufactured to be as expensive as possible and to give insurance companies and providers free rein to charge whatever the heck they want. So yes, we can make a less expensive system. Now, I support Medicare for All for the same reason that one of the same reasons I joined the military, because I'd been uninsured and underinsured most of my childhood. When you're active duty military, you have something called TRICARE. Those doctors are salaried. They don't get paid more for seeing more patients. Now, how many people listening to this know what it feels like to show up into a doctor's office? One, to be rushed out as soon as you can so they can see the next patient, but they still get to bill your insurance. And two, feel like they're pushing for you to, say, get extra things done so they can charge more. Now, I have a friend who they needed work on both their kidneys, and the doctor split it up into two different surgeries instead of doing it in one for one reason: billing. Profit? Nobody should make more money because you're more sick. Now, why I support Medicare for All even further, so that active duty healthcare, you go to the doctor, they're salaried, they're wearing a uniform, they care about taking care of you, not about making more money. And so that doctor can say, hey, I don't know that we need to get you an x-ray, but I think let's just check it out. And they don't need to fill out forms. They don't need to go through bureaucracy. They don't need to check with your insurance company. They send you up to the third floor and you get an x-ray. That's it. And that's the model that Medicare for All represents. Now, Medicare has issues. I have family members on Medicare and Social Security. But these can be addressed. There's a lot of effort among different people in the government to convince you the government can't do anything right. But guess what? The military is the government, and that was the best health care I ever had as a working class person in my entire life. And I want my family to be able to have that. My mom shouldn't have to drive 4 hours to get treatment. Shouldn't have to. And so that's why I support Medicare for All.
Would you support a compromise that kept private insurance and had a public option?
I mean, even most countries with single payer still end up with some sort of a private option for expedited treatment. Now, right now, we have some of the highest infant mortality rates in the developed world. We have some of the highest incidences of infection in the developed world. So sure, if people want to find out, you know, if they want to go above and beyond, go ahead. But we need universal preventative care, and I want to reduce the billing. I don't want the government to be handling billing. I want them to pay salaries. I want them to buy equipment, because also it's about an investment in the long term. When you have, you know, private organizations, they have to answer to their shareholders. They have quarterly meetings. We're getting passed by so many countries in this world who have had healthcare universal for decades. They're passing us by because they're planning 40, 50 years ahead, not to the next election cycle. And so, sure, you know, if people want to find options out there that are above and beyond what the government provides, but I absolutely believe single-payer universal Medicare for All needs to happen for the United States to have, you know, better outcomes. It's just an unjust system. You can talk about, how people are gonna miss out. Nobody loves their employer health care. And guess what? Your employer gets to switch it if they want. They get to change it, you know? So I do believe we need the universal single-payer system.
So you also have Green New Deal. Explain what a Green New Deal is.
Well, I mentioned earlier how the New Deal really invigorated America. And some people feel like, well, it wasn't the New Deal. It was World War II. Well, now, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the duration of the Cold War, Iraq and Afghanistan represent trillions of dollars spent, trillions of dollars spent on killing other people, just or unjust.
Do you need a refill?
Oh, I'm good. So it represents, so much death and destruction and war. The Green New Deal is about making sure people have jobs and good jobs, and that's why I support it. This district needs it.
Green New Deal is one of those words that are one of those phrases that has become a naughty word along with socialism. How do you overcome? how do you convince people rhetorically that it's something that is in their best interests?
Well, and that's the thing too. I've been frustrated about in the past is it. I think it's morally vacuous to not stand for the solutions you believe in and lobby for them with the public. The Green New Deal has a federal jobs guarantee. I know so many people who are underemployed and unemployed. They deserve a good job if they want a job. And to me, that's something that most Americans should support. They really shouldn't. So my job is to bring that policy to people and say, hey, do you want jobs? You want good paying jobs? You want jobs with good benefits? Well, then the Green New Deal offers this. And you know what? People talk about, oh, it's trying to ban cow farts. You know, that's one of the things people say. The Green New Deal is just about making sure that people have a fair shake, that they have opportunity. And the places that are going to be helped the most are going to be our rural communities here in eastern Washington.
How so?
Well, I know many folks who've, say, worked in oil fields and worked in the trades, and those are known to be good jobs. I want to bring more of those trades jobs around here. I want to make sure that if you want a job, well, guess what? Instead of building bombs like we did for World War II, you're out there building solar panels. You're installing solar panels. You're building geothermal updates for houses. You're working in all these different fields. And, you know, if it shouldn't be too hard of a sell to say, hey, this is a policy we're proposing that will get you a good job. You know, and are you really free if you don't have the opportunity to get work? If you don't work a reasonable number of hours? If you don't make a living wage? That doesn't sound much like freedom to me. Poverty in its own right is a bit of a sentence. It's a restriction of what our founders promised. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that meaning evolves over time. When the founders wrote the Constitution, life, liberty, and happiness was the best they could, they did their best to do what that could mean in the 1770s. But what that means today is very different. When it comes to health care and housing and jobs and other opportunities and a livable planet. And also, beyond that, the Green New Deal addresses clean air and water. I mean, my opponent talks about free market solutions for clean air and water. Well, before we had standards for those things, there was borax in your food, and there was baby formula with formaldehyde, and most of the cities in the country, were covered in smog. Those were the free market solutions, and so it's not really a tough sell when you get down to it and you break through the mainstream media bubble and you have that conversation with someone.
So you also propose something called the Armitage Income Justice Act. That is what?
So part of what we're hoping to do here in this race is show what a good representative would actually look like. And so the Armitage Income Justice Act is something I'm proposing, and it has a few different things. It has a $15 minimum wage tied to inflation thereafter, because that's what we had in the military. There were actually cost of living adjustments and those sorts of things. And, you know, when the minimum wage peaked in its value relative to today, it was about $22 an hour. 15 seems pretty reasonable. Another thing it has is that 51% non-executive employee ownership of publicly traded companies, which would be a massive tool to strengthen workplace democracy, labor unions. You know, it would be also it would have a cap where the highest paid employee of a company cannot receive more than 100 times as much money as the lowest paid employee, or total compensation even. And, you know, it would provide incentives for companies that have more fair wages between their highest compensated employees and their lowest.
So convince me. So tell me, what do you think about the notion of you've got the Democratic Party that is fighting between the folks who are at your end of the wing and the folks who are more toward the center? And we're talking about Bernie Sanders versus Amy Klobuchar. Convince me that America is ready for that the left side of the Democratic Party.
I'm not a really big fan of really seeing myself as to the left. I think I'm a pragmatist. I think I'm here for the working class. I'm trying to find the policies that will help our communities the most. And so the party's welcome to fight all they want, but, you know, I'm just here trying to do the best by our community. I'm not interested in intra-party fighting. You know, I've actually been amazed how much the party has really opened their arms to our campaign. The Spokane County Democrats endorsed us. The 4th Legislative District Democrats endorsed us, along with so basically we're getting support from a lot of establishment and non-establishment groups. And, you know, whatever reason you want to name for that, I think it's something to be proud of. And that's different races. You know, the presidency has gained too much power. And it's because Americans look at the president, expect them to solve everything. And so, of course, even if you're the most well-intentioned president, you're still going to try and follow through and bring people what they voted, you know, when they voted for you, what they wanted. But we have co-equal branches. And that's what I believe in. So I'm a little bit done with worrying about the presidency. I let them run their race. But we need people in Congress who are here to represent the people. And down ballot, too, further down ballot. City councils, the amount of effect you can have, even if you join your neighborhood council, is incredible. So I'm not as worried about the D versus the R versus the I versus the L. None of it. Not interested. What I'm worried about is getting in this district, talking to people who are running at all different levels and encouraging people to run, especially working class people who know what it's like to be uninsured and underinsured, know what it's like to be one paycheck from being on the streets, know what it's like to be burdened with student loan debt just because you were trying to make something for yourself. I want to support those people. It's outside of party politics. And I think too many people in this realm are all caught up in who they're fighting with and who they're arguing with in politics. That's not the 99%. That's not the majority of Americans. Most of us are just hoping we can find a good job and take care of our family. And I want an America where you can raise a family on a single income once again.
In other words, you want the 1950s back again.
Uh-huh. Interesting thing about that. So from 1958 to 1964, union membership peaked in the United States at about 35%. 35%. And that was also the period where the largest concentration of total wealth in the United States rested among the lowest 90% of earners. Now, those charts track very closely. You look at the chart of union membership and wealth distribution. And so maybe that's, you know, the slogan "Make America Great Again" was originally Ronald Reagan's, for those who don't know that. And that's the era he was talking about, the 50s and the 60s. Now, for a lot of groups, that was a horrific time. But when it came to income inequality and a lot of other things, it was a good time. Sure, you know, you could work your, you know, job, an entry-level job, and go get yourself a house and a car and raise a family for a lot of people. So in my mind, it's about moving forward towards a better future by learning from the past. Just like looking at Representative Tom Foley, I love learning about this man and speaking to people who knew him, because that's the last thing that really worked here, you know, was what he did. And it was about being with the people and trying to find the best solutions possible. He was a diplomat of a representative. And so, yeah, let's build a better future learning from what worked in the past.
So, Chris, we're almost a half hour in. What did I miss that I should have asked you about?
I can't believe it's been a half hour already.
Yeah, well, you see, you've been very passionate, and the time is gone. So what did I miss? What areas did you also want to talk about while you're here?
So I mentioned I did, you know, law enforcement, all those things. When I got out of the military, I made the next obvious career choice. I went into stand-up comedy. I was just done with all of it. I just didn't want to do serious things. I just wanted to make people laugh and have a good time. And I still worked some jobs, like background investigator for nuclear power facilities. Started some businesses, too. But it came time to jump into the race when I was talking to a friend. And he said, "I know who you don't want to vote for, but who do you want to vote for?" And I said, "I'd like to vote for someone who knows the struggles of everyday people because they've experienced them, someone who's really invested in a good future that lasts beyond any term of representation. I'm not interested in being a career politician, but I know that we need to right this ship. It's civic duty." And so if I was going to leave people with one thing, it'd be run for something. and reach out to our campaign if you want. We'd be glad to connect folks with resources because, goodness, I announced last May and the amount I've learned from when I first just started really getting involved in neighborhood councils and different volunteer groups around the area to now has just been incredible. And so I want to see more people. I want to see more nurses in Congress. I want to see more teachers in Congress. And that goes for city councils, and that goes for everything. So that's I guess, the final message. And check out armitageforcongress.com if you want to chip in a few dollars because we're unbought. We're not taking a cent of corporate money so that you know the only people who put me in office are the people of Washington's 5th Congressional District.